Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
And welcome to the show. Tonight I have with me in studio Mr. Peter Robbins. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Soraya.
As if you can't tell, Peter is actually in studio here with me at WVBR. And we're going to be talking about something we've never talked about on the air before.
That's right. Origins of the UFO ridicule factor.
Yeah, and that's something that's always fascinated me, how that's been manipulated so carefully throughout the years.
Brilliantly.
And it's not just UFOs. I mean, we're going to focus on UFOs, but it's with all types of paranormal stuff in general. They've orchestrated this sort of ridicule of it all.
In a way, we can take it back to the turn of the century, 1890s, when seances were very big. And most of them were nonsense. People longing to be in touch with their dear departed were fleeced very nicely, often with the equivalent of state-of-the-art special effects. And two extraordinary men, Harry Houdini and Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes books.
Right.
Became very interested in these fakes and spent quite a bit of time and energy exposing them. And so, rightly, the seance conductors did develop a deserved reputation as hucksters.
Yeah.
So the climate was kind of there as far as the paranormal went.
And the thing is, I don't know if they were all hucksters.
Oh, no. Well, who knows? I mean, you know, and we're not dealing with a calibrated thing that you could run through scientific apparatus to prove.
And it's also been shown that even some of the genuine psychics fake stuff, you know, because they can't call upon it, you know, at whim.
It reminds me of the old joke of why do psychics have to have conferences?
Nice.
Thank you. I'm not responsible. But everything changed in 1947 with the advent of the modern age of UFOs. And I guess, like a lot of people that get into the field, I was fascinated by the level of ridicule, condescension, sarcasm, pseudo-scientific explanations, and always the overriding mantra, it can't be, therefore it isn't, therefore it's something else. And our job as skeptical inquirers is to pat you on the head and explain, you know, to your childish imagination what's really going on here.
Well, sure, because they have their minds made up to going in, thus that's that.
Yeah.
You know?
And I separate skeptics here, which we should all be.
Yes.
And nobody more than somebody like me. Years ago, I realized I hit a point, especially after years of working as Bud Hopkins' assistant. And although a lot of people feel that the evidence to support the abduction phenomenon is all anecdotal, it is not. Multiple witnesses, physical evidence that would be perfectly at home in a felony case in a court of law, and the like. And my own childhood sighting, too much credible evidence that I've examined over the decades has left me, I'll say, I don't have the luxury of disbelief. I know we're not alone. I know something is coming and going, advanced technology, under intelligent control, and probably from numerous points, which means I have to be extra careful in each new investigation to start at the baseline and assume that it may not be real.
Right.
And ironically, as a kid, I developed a great love of the Sherlock Holmes novels. I thought they were wonderful. I still think they are. For some folks, they're a little dated, but Conan Doyle gave us a phenomenal character. And one of the things about Holmes that makes him kind of a godfather of modern detectives is what they call deductive reasoning, that, you know, a mystery would confront him and Dr. Watson, and he would investigate it from the point of view of eliminating the everyday and the mundane. For me, and I would categorize an investigation as something like Rendlesham, which I've been at on and off for almost 30 years.
Right.
Or sitting with somebody in a hotel lobby talking quietly about their experience or their allegations or whatever at a quiet moment in a conference. And even if it is just a very brief time, you have to apply the same rigorous thinking. Some colleagues, bless their hearts, also who know that we're dealing with a real thing, will assume that and take off from there, sometimes rightly or wrongly. For me, it's essential to go through the process of eliminating the most mundane, then the second most mundane, then the third. And if you go through the scale, so to say, and you don't have a realistic answer, then things begin to come interesting. Hmm. But it's not as sexy, it's time-consuming, and it's boring overall. But I think it's our responsibility to follow that course.
And the term skeptic, I mean, it means to question.
Yes.
Everything. And
yes.
You get the skeptics who have kind of hijacked that term to mean that everything must follow the status quo, the accepted explanation, and if it doesn't, then you have to, like, you know, move the moon to prove it to them.
Yeah, and the reason I even brought it up is because we should never confuse skeptics with debunkers.
Right.
Debunkers know that this isn't real. Referring to Bud again, who I should say we lost 5 years ago. Hmm. Later this month will be the anniversary. I still miss him every day. Amazing, amazing writer, investigator, and a great, great guy. But he used to joke about people like Philip Klass, aren't they amazing? They know that this phenomena is not real. We're still feeling our way around in the dark, but aren't they amazing? What a gift they have.
And I think that's the most useless thing when you deal with any kind of unexplained phenomena on either side is anyone who thinks that they know, that they have all the answers. It doesn't matter if they believe or disbelieve.
Yeah.
It's that state, you know, here's something we can't explain.
Yeah.
That every time we get a little piece of it, we have 10 more questions. But no, they know.
It's hubris. It's arrogance. And because the ridicule factor is so powerful, it doesn't matter whether it's you or me or a billionaire or a presidential candidate. It will take you down. It will take you down.
I think also, though, you have a little bit of fear there that some of these debunkers need to know that they understand the world.
Yeah.
That there can't be something that is so weird that it throws off their whole understanding of what reality is.
That's a great observation, Soraya. I realized some years into doing this work that often the most sarcastic and seemingly mean-spirited people who, oh, you're into UFOs. Oh, my goodness, you actually write about it? You behind that facade is a lot of anxiety because
sure.
If they're wrong, everything they know or think they know is called into question.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I shifted my gears from getting in their faces because it becomes like a schoolyard argument. I know you are, but what am I?
Yeah.
In the words of the great Pee Wee Herman. And tried to have some compassion for the fact that there is fear there, and rightly so. The other dynamic often in play is, let's say you are a respected professional in a field that finds this particularly touchy. I'll say the world of professional astronomy,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
the world of quote-unquote official science. If this was real, you know, I'm smart, I'm connected, I'm sophisticated, surely I'd have an inkling. Well, have you read any of what I consider the best investigative work? Please, I don't have time to read your flying saucer books. And so it's a closed loop. And
yeah.
in their little
yeah.
world, you know, That answers it all.
Well, it's Jacques Vallée offering to give Carl Sagan his 10 best cases, and Carl Sagan saying, sure, sure, do that. You collect your 10 best cases, and I'll take an honest look at them. And then when he collected them, going, I don't have time to look at that.
I'll tell you another Carl Sagan story, which won't make me popular in Ithaca, but this has got to be about 25 years ago. Bud had done a television show, and he had met Carl, you know, respected his intelligence and all. And anybody familiar with Dr. Sagan's history and his writing knows that, like Freud at the beginning of his career before he was Freud, he had tremendous courage in looking at the idea of the libido, human sexuality, as something that could be measured in a laboratory setting and that it might, in fact, have a tremendous impact on human happiness and neuroses, etc.
Mm-hmm.
With Sagan, his early work was very open about the possibility of visitations and all. But the more he became Carl Sagan, the more he backed away from it. And they had done a show together, a very good exchange of thoughts. And after the show, Bud had said, you know, Carl, if you want to come back to my home with me, I will open my files to you. Oh, thank you, Bud. And I'm paraphrasing, of course, and my memory is, you know, good, but not, you know, details of 25-odd years ago.
Right.
And what Bud ended up saying, as opposed to the 10 best cases, if I can find one case that I think is gilt-edged, absolutely authentic, in your area, Central New York State, would you take a look at it? And he said yes. And some months later, we were approached by a young man who grew up and lived in Ithaca. He had come down to the city with his girlfriend. He was mid-20s, very shaken by a lifelong series of hardcore abduction experiences. I wouldn't give the name even if I remembered it, but not only was he local, but he... his father was a professor at Cornell, who was a colleague of Carl's. And the young man worked installing home alarms, very upscale ones, and happened to install the one in Sagan's home. And he said his impression was like, you know, it was an embassy or something. It was absolutely top flight and suggested that there was a concern about, you know, major security. And Carl was famous by that point, of course. And there was no question in our mind. I mean, every criteria imaginable. He was smart. He was an underachiever professionally, as quite a number of abductees seem to be. And, you know, he could have been going for his own degrees, but he was working installing alarms. He was also struggling with drug addiction. And Bud brought the case to Carl's attention, told him who it was, how he was connected to Sagan, and Sagan declined the invitation. Now, I'm not saying it would have made a difference if he would have met with him and Carl would have heard him out, but...
to not give it a chance.
Yeah. Less than a year later, the kid died of an overdose. I mean, a real tragic story, and not to, you know, blame Dr. Sagan for
it. Well, sure.
But these things happen. It's real. It's as real as it can be.
And I think also when you have someone like Sagan who's in such a high position, he has to go with the status quo. He doesn't really have a choice or he's going to become just an outcast.
Yeah. I'll tell you one other anecdote. And I know this from somebody who was there. In the old days, I don't know how they do it now, but in the Ithaca public school system, at the just before the beginning of the official year, literally everyone, teachers, drivers, anybody who worked at the schools, all got together for a large meeting. And it was always followed by a talk by somebody. And on this occasion, it was Dr. Sagan. You know, somebody just to add a special note. And this person told me that he was charming, articulate, fascinating. And finally, somebody raised their hands and asked him, you know, what's the story about UFOs? And they said he visibly changed. The words started to come out very automatically. It was almost like a rehearsed piece, or so it felt. There was more sense of monotone. And it was so awkward for this person, and they picked up for other people in the room, that when he finished, everybody left. It was just, there was nowhere to go with the discussion.
Well, here's the official thing I'm supposed to say. Here you go. And again, you know, when your job hinges on you keeping your mouth shut on what you may actually think is
That's out there.
Because he didn't know either one way or the other. As far as I'm concerned, there's nobody who knows what's going on.
Yeah. And I always like working with you because you bring up such good points. When you encounter somebody who says they do know, and I mean the specifics, and one of my favorite examples is dear Dr. Stephen Greer,
who's famous
for saying,
there.
Well, you know, Steve earned it. He's done good work. His initial disclosure event in 2000 was world-class, very courageous, and historic. But then, you know, he'll go on record as saying there are 58 alien races visiting our planet. And I don't care who you are. And I'll say, if you were the president of the United States, the head of the NSA, the head of every world government, and the supreme rulers of, let's say, 24 alien races, you could not establish that as absolutely factual, empirical, because there is no way of knowing. And it just is a perfect example for that kind of nonsense, or that all other intelligences are good.
Yeah.
And the abduction experiences that are creepy, they're all military, because the, you know, the government wants to poison you against the other intelligences because they're all good, and, you know, give them bad PR because the governments are evil.
I would think any intelligence, just like any intelligence on this planet, human or otherwise, has good and bad to it.
I think that's absolutely the way to look at the vastness of the possibilities of visitations from other cultures, from parts unknown.
Yeah. And who knows who we're being visited by that we don't even know are here.
Bada bing.
You know, things that are just outside our perspectives.
Yeah. A dimension or two away.
And we talked about Stephen Greer with on our last, one of the last two UFO histories with Mike Cleland and Aaron Gullius. And Aaron, was it Aaron? No, I guess it was Mike saying that, you know, they were looking at lights that they basically summoned in the sky. And he's looking at this light, and Steven's sitting there talking about how it's a mothership, and it's coming into view. And he's going, it's a light. How do you know this? You know, where's this information coming from? You're putting it onto this light that, sure, we seem to have summoned into existence. But to call it a mothership is jumping way ahead. And when he did his Sirius documentary, I thought it was a decently done documentary.
Oh, sure. Great production values.
And they kind of, you know, they get to the end and they find out that this thing is probably human, and they just kind of bury that. And it's kind of like, no, that's still interesting, because this is a very unique specimen of human, if it's really human.
Crucial. I know people that have, you know, gone out on night watches with him and paid a lot and have seen some extraordinary things. Other people who said, I heard the noise of the aircraft. Mm. And people were so enwrapt that they ignored it.
Right.
And
right.
like you say, a mothership, let's vector it in with our flashlights.
Yeah. So anyway, let's go back to the origins of the ridicule factor here. And this, so we have Kenneth Arnold's sightings.
Yeah.
And Roswell, I mean, Roswell more picked up steam in the 80s. So did that really factor into this so much?
Well, it did momentarily. Mm. We don't know the exact day that the thing or things came down, or whether it was a result of some theorized of a very bad electrical storm or what have you. I take it very seriously and have been had the privilege of seeing and spending time with some of the best people in the field. As you know, one of the coolest jobs I ever worked was the 2 years that I was a consultant for the city, working out of the mayor's office, Mayor Legrone.
In Roswell.
Well, no, from New York City.
Oh, from New York City, okay.
And from up here. And one of my jobs was to be liaison with the city of Roswell on any matter related to UFOs with Governor Richardson, which was very cool.
Hmm.
Otherwise, it was to build what the mayor and I felt would be responsible tourism, working to build junkets from around the world. The name Roswell is as recognizable a brand, if you will, as Coca-Cola. And they certainly have the right to work it if they could.
Sure, absolutely.
When the mayor lost his job, though, I lost mine. And a new mayor came in who was much more anxious about the subject and had problems with it, and the rest is history, or lack of it at this point. But
the fact that that existed at all is really interesting.
Yeah. Whether it was the very end of June or the very beginning of July, you know, choose your date.
When was the year-wise, when did this happen?
We're talking July of 1947.
No, I mean when you were the liaison.
Oh, 08 to 2010.
Oh, okay. So just a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. And the when it happened, it's a very important timeline. The Kenneth Arnold sightings, for any of your listeners that are not familiar with them, on June 24th, about a week and a half before Roswell, a private pilot named Kenneth Arnold was flying his plane in the Cascade Mountain Range in Washington State and observed, the number varies a bit, 9, 10, whatever it was, disc-shaped objects, seemingly with kind of a cut out of the back. And he was able to get a very good estimate of their speed based on the fact that he was flying toward them and the time that it took them to fly from the top of Mount Rainier to another mountaintop. He was able to establish that they were going at about 1,800 miles an hour. 1947, that's pretty damn fast.
Right.
It's pretty fast now. The reason that the story broke internationally when it did was that not long before this, a plane had gone down, and Civil Air Patrol was out looking for it. So there were reporters at the airport when he landed. He gave his account. And when one of the reporters asked him to describe it, he said it was like, you know, a stone or a saucer skipping across the water if you scaled
it. Right.
And, of course, that phrase, flying saucer, as in flying cup and saucer, was just irresistible. And don't kid yourself, it was that simple.
Yeah.
The ridicule was supported by this very lighthearted kind of verbal description. Well, within days, these things were appearing over more and more states, multiply viewed by very credible witnesses. I think within a week and a half, they were over, I don't know, 20 states or so. And there was no question that the phenomenon was real. Now, let's place this in a bigger time frame. It's 1947, it's summer. We're now 2 years out of World War II. America, in many ways, was the country that we wish it were now. We had helped our allies defeat the Nazis and the Axis forces, making the world safe for democracy. However, the Soviet Union was more and more making it clear that we had a new enemy in no uncertain terms.
Yep.
And in the July, I you know, coincidences sometimes are just that, but when it overlaps in history, it can be really worth noting and sometimes just fascinating. In this case, the very distinguished publication Foreign Affairs, a monthly that's been published for, I'm sure, 60, 70 years. The lead article was of the July 1947 issue was called On Containment, and it was written by a brilliant young political scientist under the pseudonym of X. And in it, he theorized that if the West could hold the Soviets within the borders that they had expanded to by the end of World War II, moving into Eastern Europe, etc., and hold them within an allegorical iron curtain, that we could avoid a hot war or a shooting war and have a cold war, hence the derivation of these terms. Well, George Kennan went on to advise a record-breaking like 10 American presidents. He lived to be 101. And in fact, on containment became American foreign policy for the next 45 years until the Soviet Union disintegrated in 89 and 90 and things changed. So it is fair to say that the Cold War and the modern age of UFO sightings were born in the same historic moment. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, there were UFO sightings before Kenneth Arnold.
Yes, no question. Going back to time immemorial.
Right, but this is the point where the modern understanding and realization of UFOs came into being.
Yeah, and in great part, and with good reason, because, again, within weeks, they were being seen over other countries as well.
Yeah.
And other credible reports were coming in. So let's take a moment and try and put ourselves back in this period of time. You had Harry Truman as president, a tough son of a bee, an everyman who had risen to be president because of a political deal where he received the vice presidential nomination on Roosevelt's fourth term. Roosevelt wanted nothing to do with him. They met once or twice. He knew nothing and was prepared to while away his time in the vice president's office. And then April 12th, 1945, Roosevelt dies in Warm Springs, Georgia. One of the greatest and most interesting and important people of the 20th century, whose name nobody knows unless you're in this work, was Dr. Vannevar Bush. He was President Roosevelt's, then President Truman's, chief scientific advisor. He was also the head of research and development for the American military. And if you take the MJ-12 seriously, and I do, although I think a lot of the papers are very questionable, he was MJ-12 number one. He wrote three terrific books, Modern Arms and Free Men, and then two memoirs. The second one in 67, not long before he died, kind of picking up on an early hip phrase called Pieces of the Action. I forget the name of the first memoir. They're all still eminently readable, and he talks brilliantly about the people that he worked with at the time. And he talks in Pieces of the Action that it was his job that afternoon in April, the president dies that morning, to walk into the Oval Office, and there is Harry Truman sitting at the desk all by himself, and essentially say, Mr. President, it is my solemn responsibility to inform you. Among other things, of a top-secret project called the Manhattan Project. Mm. Truman had no idea about the bomb. But I like Truman. I've read his memoirs. I've read his letters. I find him a fascinating guy. And he really was an everyman. I think if it had been left to him, as opposed to understandable pressure and concern from the circle of advisors he'd had pulled in, 12 top people, military, science, sociology, etc., to advise him, that he set up a study committee and that these men took the possibility very seriously that these things might be extraterrestrial in nature.
Right.
And after prolonged months of study, it's my feeling, based on a lot of reading, critical thinking, common sense, and deductive reasoning, that he may well have been ready to go forward. Imagine, you know, let's say late 1947, the President of the United States goes on the radio and says, my fellow Americans, it's my solemn duty to inform you that these phenomena that we've been seeing for months, in fact, some of them do represent very likely technology beyond our imagination, under the control of intelligences from parts unknown, and we are in a new world. How different the world would have evolved. Mm. Perhaps for the better.
Maybe.
I think one thing, the whole idea of the disclosure movement and the idea of disclosure, which I don't think our government will ever willingly commit to, and I'm convinced, like a number of my colleagues, it's going to happen anyway, and in fact, we are in the process right now, although it's kind of slow-mo for a lot of folks. For other people, it can never be slow enough. They don't want to know, and that's most of the folks. And I think that his advisors convinced him that we need to keep studying this. We need to keep making analyses. We've got to crack this thing or find out something or develop a countermeasure, which of course never happened.
Right.
And we talk about our national security state, something that in terms of ufology and American history, nobody has articulated better than Richard M. Dolan in his books, UFOs and the National Security State 1 and 2, mm-hmm. with the third volume on the way at some point in the future. If you think about that thing they were trying to cover up as a grain of sand, the UFO phenomena, it may actually be, you know, extraterrestrial or interdimensional, whatever, that put it in an oyster, it's irritating. The way pearls form is it calcifies. It creates more and more layers on it that are not sharp and pointy, and that's how you get pearls. I think the origins of our entire national security world go back to that summer of 1947 with that grain of sand, and other things followed. Where I became really interested in this area of study to the point of obsession was some years into you know, being an investigator, a researcher, writer, I just really started to think about it a lot. And what I kind of came up with was it didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense. And what I mean by that is, let's just say we grew up in a world without this phenomenon. And one afternoon, you know, we're friends like we are now, I run into you in downtown Ithaca and say, Soraya, the damnedest thing happened to me yesterday. I was playing with the kids in the yard yesterday afternoon and walking the dog last night, and I looked up and I saw this thing or things. I've never seen anything or things like them. It was round or oblong, or it was a rectangle, it was a triangle. It went faster than anything I've ever seen or just hovered, but it couldn't have. It was too big. It made no noise. It zigzagged. It was as big as a quarter being held at arm's length at one point. A second later, it was as big as a star. And, you know, one of them landed on the neighbor's lawn when it took off. There was a hole burned there. I wonder what it was. Now, in a sane world, you would probably say or think to yourself, gee, that's interesting. I wonder what it was, too.
Right.
So how is it that a simple report of any type like that is greeted almost universally, except by people who have made it their business to school themselves to the contrary? What's wrong with Peter? Is he has a mental problem? Is he gone mystical on me? Does he want to feel special? One of my favorites. Does he want to be famous? Does he want to be TV? Is he trying to fool me for some reason? Where the hell did that thinking come from? Again, it's totally counterintuitive.
And it is, and you figure most people who have these reports don't become famous. Mm. If they do become famous for it, like Whitley Strieber, it's not necessarily a good thing.
No. And the idea of being in it for the money, of course, is hysterically funny for those of us who are, of course, in it for the money. I'm waiting. But at a certain point early on in working on Left at East Gate, with Larry Warren, the book we wrote about the Rendlesham incident, I needed to back off. I really needed to back off. But I could not spend those months not addressing some aspect of UFO studies. I was obsessed. And I started to spend time at what they call the newspaper morgue of the New York Times. I had been studying the media in the 40s. Now, of course, it was completely different then. 95% of all Americans got their news from newspapers.
Right.
Radio was coming into its own. Television was, you know, there were experimental ones, but it wasn't a reality yet. The most influential newspaper in the United States was the New York Times. It had been published since before the Civil War. It had a tremendous impact on other national chains and newspapers around the country. And I thought, this is a good place to start. What did the Times think about this? And in the old days, you literally worked out of huge pebble-covered ledgers I mean, something, they were really Dickensian. And everything was cross-referenced. Of course, the term UFO wasn't being used. Unidentified flying objects didn't come into its own until 55 or 56. And right. Now, in official circles, it's becoming passé, and it's what? UAP?
Yeah, unexplained aerial phenomena.
Right, right. Thank you, Mrs. Clinton, on that. And who will, of course, reveal all when she becomes president, like we're holding our breath. Good Lord. Oh, God, I get a headache every time I think of the candidates. I'm off on a tangent. And you'd find a reference. And interestingly, it took me a while to kind of get up to speed because I was looking at flying saucers, of course, unidentified aerial objects, unidentified aerial phenomena. The term spaceship and extraterrestrial actually did not exist in American English. And I thought, how come I'm not finding anything. This is all pre-digital. Because there were always two words, extraterrestrial and spaceship. When I started looking under those, I found other things. And you'd get a reference number. You'd take it to the microfiche librarian, who, you know, like in high school, would give you the microfiche. You'd go through the machine. You'd find the article. You'd put in your quarter, or when I was a child, a penny. Just kidding. And you'd print it out, as close as I ever got to slot machines. And I started to build my file of these things. And then I returned to the book, and everything changed, and went back to it years later. Now everything's digitized. Mm-hmm. And I was able to do more complete searches, print things out easier, and ended up with well over 200 printed pieces, everything from major front page articles to minor coverage, to photographs, letters to the editor, editorials, commentaries, captions under photographs. And at a certain point, I had essentially a complete collection of all of the coverage that the New York Times had ever done. Sometimes they'd go for several years without even a piece. Other times, and the height of it was the Washington in response to the Washington, D.C. overflights in 1952.
Yeah.
On one day, they had five different pieces in the New York Times. I mean, incredible. Wow. The Voronezh case in 1989, a very famous Soviet case.
Mm-hmm. That was with the giants, right, and the school kids?
Yeah, and kind of these robot-type things. Voronezh is a city about 800 miles due south and just east of Moscow. It was an amazing case and multiply witnessed and taken very seriously. I actually ended up corresponding in depth with an associate professor of, I think it was stress in materials at a local trade college. And we were able to exchange some remarkable information. He was fascinated by Rendlesham, and we found that there were tremendous similarities in the physiological results of where these things touch down. Background beta and gamma readings and stuff like that, descriptions of the craft, etc. And they also kind of flipped out at that point, and I could only think of Shakespeare's wonderful line of "The lady doth protest too much." The New York Times did not even touch the Roswell story, and every other paper in America did when it blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly there, what happened was Mac Brazel, who was a ranch foreman, reported to the local military base, which was the Roswell Army Airfield. Small base outside of a small town in a small town in New Mexico, but a crucially and historically important base, because in the summer of 1947, 1947, there was only one nuclear strike force in the world, the 509th Bomb Wing of the Army Air Corps. The Air Force was still several months away. It didn't go into existence until September. And the base intelligence officer, Major Jesse Marcel, and another officer went out to the debris field with Brazel. And what they encountered was not of this earth, not of this world, although some may tell you differently. a large contingent of troops was brought out there, swept the area, picked up every fragment they could find. And I think much to his credit, although now he would have had his head handed to him, the base commander, a tough, no-nonsense World War II veteran, General Butch Blanchard, I forget his real first name, a very distinguished officer who had a great career, told Marcel to make it public that they had recovered pieces from a genuine crashed flying saucer, for lack of a better term. He never cleared it with the Pentagon. Can you imagine? And so Marcel, who had taken pictures with the debris, made the press release, and the world went a bit nuts for 24 hours. When the Pentagon learned of it, which is immediately, they read him the Riot Act. They put the heat on Marcel, not Blanchard. And the following day, in probably the most humiliating and destructive day of his life, this extremely decent army officer was ordered to pose with fragments of a crashed Mogul weather balloon. He was never the same after that. He became a chronic depressive, wrestled with alcoholism, and it's only through the efforts of Stanton Friedman, who, through a lead, found him living, retired in his late 80s in Alabama in either 79 or 80, and did the interview and got him on record. And thank God for his amazing son, Jesse Jr., who we lost about 2 years ago, who never backed down from that memory of his dad waking him up, telling him to come down to the kitchen. And there on the table was a cardboard box filled with parts.
Right, right.
Jesse Jr., who was, I don't know, 8 or 11 or in there, asked his dad if he could keep a part, and his father said yes. And not that long after, a day or two, MPs came to the house, questioned him, got the piece back, and et cetera.
Sure, sure.
But that... the initial coverage was explosive, and it went around the world. And the New York Times didn't even touch it.
Hmm.
You know, you can find, you go to the, you know, go to the historical record, you'll see newspapers all over the United States covered it, and a lot in Europe. However, once the explanation was made, it was dropped. And that next day, that began the New York Times coverage of the phenomenon. And the level, and I mean when they hit the floor running with the first article, the level of sarcasm, condescension, making fun, dismissiveness was actually kind of shocking. You know, there was nothing even remotely objective about it. And I would say, and I'm probably the only person, certainly that I know, who has read every single article the New York Times has read, written on this. And in order. And coming from the background of being an artist, I tend to think out of the box and fairly right-brained. I was looking for a pattern in the reporting. And on the surface, it really wasn't discernible. And so I thought, well, if I put these articles together and I just read them all and read them again and read them again, I'm going to have a little light bulb moment and I'll see it. And it was classic, like 2 in the morning on the 6th reading or something. I said, here it is. And whether or not it was a front page piece or a tiny paragraph, the form was basically, here's something that somebody says they saw. Well and good. Here's the things it could have been, probably was. Let us trot out an authority, in quotes. Almost never named in the early years. I mean, an astronomer that we know, or a psychologist, two groups that are particularly touchy, mental health professionals and space scientists about being wired up with flying saucers and little green men.
Sure.
Within a week, an article appeared that was so contemptuous that it ended with this unnamed mental health professional or astronomer, I don't remember, when they asked him what he thought about the phenomena. He quoted a line from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. The line was, "Twinkle, twinkle, little bat, how I wonder where you're at. Up above, the world so high, like a tea tray in the sky. Ha, ha, ha. And I would say probably about 95% of all of the Times coverage from that point on, even though over the decades it grew somewhat more sophisticated, was earmarked by condescension, sarcasm, dismissiveness, and loopy explanations. If you just study the coverage from July alone of 1947, you've got it all. In fact, I think it was the most brilliant disinformation campaign in the history of disinformation. By the end of 47, the American public was convinced. It can't be, therefore it isn't, therefore it's something else.
Right.
It's war jitters. We're all concerned about the Russians. It's, we have some new things going on in the sky. We're making improvements to the German V-2s. It could be a Soviet thing over the United States. Or it could be a car going up a hill with its headlights bouncing off a cloud. It could be hailstones that flatten out as they come down and have lights hit them. It could be dust on the eyeball.
Of course.
No. It could be pressure within the eyeball. All of this absolutely dead serious. And then once we come into the 50s, they find and connect with the first legendary debunker, Donald K. Menzel, a man who truly led two lives. Dr. Menzel was the head of astronomy at Harvard, very distinguished academic, very respected in the world of astronomy, who in fact was an asset of the national security apparatus in this country. And one of the greatest research papers I ever heard, had a tremendous impact on me, was at a really memorable MUFON symposium, 1987, 40th anniversary of Roswell and Kenneth Arnold. It was in Washington, D.C., and Stan Friedman gave a paper called The Secret Life of Dr. Donald K. Menzel. And I remember being enrapt, thinking, I had met Stan, you know, he's one of my heroes, and I thought, this is exciting. This is what research is really about. What Friedman had done had been, he's the first person to get permission from Harvard, from the National Archives, and from Menzel's widow to go through all his papers, and was able to establish beyond any doubt that Menzel was, in fact, an asset of our national security.
Sure.
And it wasn't the council. Well, the council existed, but not in, maybe it did in early, I know it went into effect in 47, I don't remember when. It wasn't the National Security Agency, because that wasn't until the beginning of the Eisenhower administration. But I thought, this is important. And Menzel was the go-to guy until he handed the torch to Philip Klass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the reason to ridicule this stuff, I think, is twofold. One, they don't want people looking into it. Because the phenomena seems to interact with people.
That's right.
Not the government.
Yeah.
And B, it gives them a nice, healthy cover-up for any projects they want to do. Because someone sees one of their planes in the sky, and they can say, oh, look at these idiots seeing UFOs.
That's right. It even extends from there. Let's imagine for a moment that through, because it ain't going to happen through the American government unless the hand is forced in some way that we can only imagine. Let's say it happens through an incredible WikiLeaks release, or a number of people with really good amateur telescopes start to promote photographs they've taken of things on the moon that ain't ours.
Right.
And there are structures on the moon, there's no question. Maybe that might be the thing that breaks it open. However, if you are running a country, one of your greatest assets is to keep people pumped up with nationalism. They're the other, here's our line in the dirt.
Sure.
We're the best country in the world, you know, they're our enemy. We've always got to remember that we're Americans first or Russians first or whatever first and, you know, human beings second. Ronald Reagan said it all. Reagan, who had at least two remarkable events, one of them as governor, an extraordinary sighting from the plane that everyone saw and then talked to friends about it. It was a remarkable interview with the pilot as well. They were being tracked very closely by a disc-shaped object. Trying to remember the year exactly, but I think it was before the 45th General Assembly meeting, Reagan gave one of his most famous talks for those of us in the field. And at a certain point in his talk, he segued. And it began, I believe, with the words, "I often wonder what if we were faced with a threat from outer space. Wouldn't we then come together and see ourselves as human beings first?"
Yeah.
And it was a brilliant passage. And then he did something extremely clever, which was tail off to, but I forget the wording exactly, but it's certainly in the public record. "But isn't there already, you know, an invader among us? Hunger, poverty, ignorance," and
right.
took off from there. A friend and colleague of mine, Ron Regeer, lives out west. Years ago, he told me that he had had an opportunity to interview one of Reagan's major speechwriters. And because I possess such an unbelievably powerful memory, I even remember the speechwriter's name. Who knows how I'm able to retain this information? It was his name is Peter Roberts. Go figure. And he asked him, he said, "You worked on that speech. Did you write that part?" Roberts told him, "No, not only did I not, but if you, as a scholar, can get permission to see the original manuscript of that in the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California, you will see it's all written out in the margin in the president's handwriting." That was his baby completely. Well, if it's real, they still point back to something that you'd think, "You're kidding me. They actually were able to work this," which, for anybody that's interested in the history of radio, you've got to seek this thing out. It is the October 30th, 1938 broadcast of the Mercury Theater of the Air, Orson Welles' wonderful mm-hmm. repertory company, where a terrific writer for the radio named Howard Fass had been assigned the job of updating and modernizing H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds.
Right.
And his story doesn't open in England. It opens in a town called Grover's Mill, New Jersey. The reason? Well, he had to come up with some town. And as he said, "I had a big map of the United States in my study. I closed my eyes and went, bunk. Sorry, New Jersey, it's you." And it's an amazing radio play.
Oh, sure.
And what it does, I actually have an LP of it, but you can find it online.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And for anybody, you know, that thinks, "Oh, God, radio, how boring," give yourself a treat and, you know, play it out in your mind rather than having to look at a screen. What they do is nothing short of the invasion and almost total destruction of the world before the germs get to the Martians and, you know, we rebuild our society. But they collapse weeks into this one radio show. And it had breaks. It had commercial breaks, which probably if the Martians were invading, they wouldn't be having commercial sponsors. That's when people ran to their phones. Well, there was a certain level of panic. And again, following up with that, if anybody's interested in getting the amazingly somewhat boring but fascinating stats on what really was going on, what phone lines around the country, you know, got overloaded. People rushing in Manhattan to the Hudson River to see New Jersey in flames. You know, people who, you know, had heart attacks.
Yeah, yeah.
These things happened. There is a book that was published by Princeton University Press years ago called The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Mass Psychology of Panic, written by a Princeton scholar named Hadley Cantrell, C-A-N-T-R-I-L. You can pick it up for a couple of bucks used online. And it's fascinating. But they hark back to that, the idea of mass panic. And who's to say it wouldn't have happened? There was also the risk of a stock market crash. of, you know, a crisis among people of faith, et cetera, that nobody wanted to take responsibility for the possibility of.
The broadcast also, if I'm not mistaken, spoke constantly about how it was a play. Yeah. And not real, and yet it still had people in the panic.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but at the end of it, when people turned off their radios and, you know, then called their neighbors, Orson Welles comes on and says, essentially, it's the night before Halloween. Yeah. This was our way of saying, boo, have a happy Halloween.
I thought they had announced it at the beginning and some point in the middle as well.
It, you know, I have to listen to it again, but he... I don't remember whether they went home or he took a nap at the studio. And the next thing he knows, I think it's Sarnoff or, you know, somebody very high up at NBC. I think it was NBC saying, get down here right now. And he was shocked, embarrassed, overwhelmed that he had set this thing in motion. But it's a tap on the shoulder and a reminder that people can be influenced, especially in a more innocent time like that. But, you know, you and I, we take this subject seriously. We've read a lot of books. We've done our own investigations. You've interviewed so many of the best personalities and writers and thinkers in the field. There's a part of us that is, for lack of a better term, ready. Although whoever's really ready. But all the more reason we need to remind ourselves we are so in the minority of the American and the world population, although we like to think otherwise. And for those people who, disclosure now, everything, you know, power to the people, yes and no. I mean, I was like that when I first started, activist, I would have gone into the streets for it, except I knew, you know, you saw the early demonstrations in front of the White House of six people holding placards. Jesus, you know, they just look like such goofballs.
Yeah, it didn't help their cause.
Content and form can be equally important.
So do you think War of the Worlds influenced the decision to kind of ridicule this stuff and keep it quiet?
There's no question that it was in the minds of some fairly high up. The first major study of the UFO phenomena that the Air Force conducted, a secret study, was Project Sign, declassified now, 40-odd pages, as I recall. And it's very analytical. The whole first three-quarters of it is dry as a bone, but just the way it should be, looking at every possibility from the most mundane to the second most mundane. And then you get to a point where you see those two words at a topic heading, spaceships. And at that point, that bureaucratic voice, and it was written by committee, but you hear an individual voice and a real thinker saying to the effect, if there, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, if there are such civilizations in existence who can get from there to here, and they're thinking, you know, an almost charming way of, wow, you know, with the most advanced propulsive source that we can think of, it'd take them 2 years at least. that they are obviously in advance of us. But here's what becomes absolutely prophetic. And it's like a line out of the script, you know, and something that didn't get into the script of one of my favorite golden age science fiction movies, The Day the Earth Stood Still, where what they're saying is 2 years ago, 1945, we did something on this planet that could be observed and measured from outer space. We started to explode nuclear bombs. In 100 years, we're going to be out in our rockets with bigger and better weapons and our same unstable, aggressive human psychology. In light of past human behavior, they should be alarmed. And above all else, we should be anticipating seeing such things now in the sky. It's absolutely breathtaking in its conciseness, its simplicity, and as far as I'm concerned, its accuracy. Should say here, too, that some people may say, well, this is, you know, getting out of hand. Soraya's got a guest on who's a little loopy here, even though I'm not feeling completely comfortable with this. The connections between them and their seeming interest in nuclear sites of one sort or another is endemic. And some years back, an investigator, author, writer named Robert Hastings, who interestingly I was back and forth with briefly today because he'll be giving the keynote speech at the International MUFON Symposium the end of this month near Orlando, which I'll be hosting as the MC and just going over a few basics. Robert wrote a very important book called UFOs and Nukes.
Yeah.
It's as big as Left at Eastgate. It's over 500 pages. And it's the real deal. The connections, the established cases, the proof, the paper trail is amazing, which many of us feel is why this whole thing kicked off in earnest in Roswell. There was only one nuclear installation in the world, and that was it. Small town in New Mexico, small city now, 50,000 people or so. But that's the way it was. And to just jump in with one other slightly connected thing, because I like when I speak to be able to couch subjects that are referred to in established post-war history. I think it's especially for intelligent, reasonable skeptics who are wrestling with this. If you can present this information in a cogent enough way to get them into the foyer, get them through that first door, then I've done my job, and leave it to others to channel Martians and you know, cite all the important stuff. I visited the old Roswell Army Airfield a number of times. I've visited Roswell five or six times, been there for up to a week or two. And especially when I was working there, I got into the only remaining aircraft hangar from that era. Hmm. And except for a coat of paint, it's just like it was in 1947.
Nice.
That is where we understand debris and bodies were taken before being flown out to 8th Army headquarters in Texas. I think El Paso, I forget. Well, that was in July of 47, 23 months earlier. In August of 45, I'd have to say above top secret mission began there, where a bomber flew, left that hangar, complete secrecy, made a stop in, I'm trying to remember now whether it was California or one of the island bases that we had on our way to Japan, loaded a weapon, and the Enola Gay went on to drop the bomb on Hiroshima. Today is the anniversary, for what it's worth.
Mm.
That building should have a giant historic plaque on it. If people want to ignore the Roswell, people should know that's where the Enola Gay left from, Roswell, New Mexico.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I know in the one of the more frightening aspects of a UFO over a nuclear base was the one where it was actually turning on the missiles.
Turning them off,
that's right, okay.
Yeah, and one of the best cases we have was one from 1967, and my friend Robert Salas, a former Air Force captain at the time, was beginning his career. I believe he's a lieutenant, with a very responsible job, Malmstrom Air Force Base in Dakota, Montana. Christ, such an East Coaster. But he was in charge of the screens governing a number of ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and was listening to the chatter coming from witnesses on the ground. He was underground, observing UFOs coming in over the base, and watched as one missile after another was shut down. We know the same thing happened at RAF Bentwaters during the incursion there in late 1980, and numerous, numerous other cases. Colonel Halt, the former deputy base commander's phrase, and he said it to my face, and Larry Warren's, and Bob Exler, a researcher who was fairly active back when we met with Halt in the early 90s, that he couldn't explain it, but that they had, quote-unquote, adversely affected the ordinance. Thank God they adversely affected it in the least adverse way.
Right, right. Rather than launching it.
Bingo.
Yeah, and that's something that's hard to ignore, that they can do that. I mean, does it rule out, however, the idea that these things could be from, as Richard Dolan is researching, a breakaway civilization?
That's right. And we have to pay attention to all the possibilities. Rich, I think, is one of our... He's really one of the best minds in the field, and certainly one of the most articulate and smartest. He's also a dear friend and a close colleague, and I have tremendous respect for his work. But somebody is doing this stuff, and to ignore it is a fool's paradise. To address it is very difficult for most people, and it's why we have to thank people like Hastings for his important book. It brings this very specific, hyper-specific subject more credibility and helps people educate themselves on the reality of the phenomena, even in what some might think, especially if you've never read any of the best literature on it. Sounds like, science fiction musings.
I remember Jacques Vallée saying that as a kid he had a UFO sighting, and that got him interested in the subject, and he decided he was going to become an astronomer so he could study UFOs. And I had that same thinking growing up. I wanted to be an astronomer to study UFOs until I found out that's not how it works. But he didn't get that awakening until he was already an astronomer, and he saw them destroying data tracks of unidentified objects that the observatory had tracked.
Yeah.
And he said to them, "Why would you destroy this? This is the most amazing thing we could possibly discover." And they said, "We're not coming out with this. If the United States comes out with it, we'll back them up, but we're not going to be the ones to put this out in public. We'll be the laughingstock of the world."
You're absolutely right. And you do this work long enough, hopefully you do it well, you get some respect from people, some who will keep an eye on you for years if they have an account, something that happened to them. They want to know you're the real deal. And
sure.
In some cases, I've had people come to me who said, I've been following your work for X number of years, and as far as I'm concerned, you're credible, you're worthy of respect, you're honest, and you admit your mistakes when you make them. And I'll share something with you. This has got to be close to 30 years ago. I was giving a talk somewhere in the Midwest. And when it was all over, I had gone out to the parking lot, I think, to have a cigarette. And it wasn't a huge audience. In fact, it was in a bookstore. Maybe I had 40 people there.
Mm-hmm.
A gentleman who I had noticed in the audience came up to me, thanked me for my talk, and said, I will share something with you that, as far as I'm concerned, you're free to share. I've written about it once. I've talked about it a few times. But you will never attach my name to it. And I thought, interesting. He even gave me his business card. He was a former employee of the National Security Agency. He told me enough that I took him very seriously and still do. And that when he was younger, he had been stationed at a listening station in a very remote part of Turkey. I had traveled when I was younger through some very remote parts of Turkey. And he was quite impressed when he found out that I knew where it was in the Ezrum Samson area. And I had driven through there in the dead of winter. And he said, essentially, it went like this. And I'll send you the article, Soraya. We were working away. It was winter, very cold out. And we were observing unknowns coming in from out there. And, it became non-routine fairly quickly. And a number of us stood around the scope and watched with fascination and then a certain amount of concern and amazement as they came in right over our area. And, you know, a couple of us got our parkas out, went outside, and we could see them. And they were truly anomalous for a number of reasons. Of course, we reported it immediately. And the next morning, NSA reps, probably stationed in Istanbul, or more likely the capital of Turkey, showed up the next morning. They said, get the tapes, show us all of the entries in the logbooks relative to this. They pulled together the tapes, they opened the logbooks. Thank you very much. They removed all the material. Said, this never happened. Everybody understand? This never happened. And that was the story, basically.
Yeah.
Things like this have happened repeatedly all over the world. Men and women, you know, have the stories. They either are keeping them to themselves because they took a security oath and more power to them, or at a certain point in their lives, they decide to share them. And a number of them are extremely credible.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to bring this to a close. You have a couple of events coming up. You want to tell people about those?
I do. At the end of this month, the last weekend, the weekend of the 27th, 28th of August, down in the Orlando area, we have the annual International MUFON Symposium. I will not be a speaker there this year, but I will be hosting it, in a sense. I will be the MC, announcing my colleagues, and looking forward to seeing a lot of friends. MUFON Symposium is always one of the best organized conferences of the year. After familiarizing myself with the speakers roster, a number of them are good old friends of mine and colleagues, a few I've never heard. It's a terrific lineup. And if you've never been to a UFO conference and you can get to one, this would certainly be a great introduction. The irony for me is for the past 3 years, I've been very proud to MC and speak at a very different UFO conference. And rather than being in the Southeast, in the Northeast, because of a schedule change, there was a conflict for me. I had taken the MUFON job, looking forward to, once again, hosting the Experiencers Speak UFO conference in Portland, Oregon, which comes up the same weekend, August 27th, 28th. I was very disappointed that I couldn't be there, as were the organizers, and I immediately was able to enroll Richard Dolan to MC it and speak, and I think that will only up the attendance. This is a very special conference. Your standard UFO conference is hopefully respected speakers, authors, researchers, investigators, and every once in a while, a token abductee, experiencer. But the lion's share are not folks who necessarily ever even saw one.
Yeah.
Experiencer Speak was begun by Debbie Hewen, a remarkable young woman, and her sister, Audrey Hewen, and her sister, Debbie, identical twins who grew up in Maine, lifelong abductees, and I'm not speaking out of school here, who basically hard work, putting up the money, family putting up the money, created this conference where, except for two or three speakers like myself, it's all abductees and experiencers. We've always featured a well-known one or two. This year it'll be Travis Walton and Charlie Foltz, who was involved in a very famous UFO abduction case, the Allagash case.
Right.
Four old friends, two of them brothers, camping out, who were taken literally from their canoe. Two of them professional artists, and so the recovered memories and the remembered memories brilliantly presented in their presentation. So remember those two URLs, the MUFON Symposium in Orlando and the Experiencers Speak conference in Portland, Oregon, end of this month. the next weekend, the first weekend in September, Exeter, New Hampshire, famous for being very close to the Betty and Barney Hill incident and its own incident. Beautiful Exeter, New Hampshire, like out of a Curry-and-Rice print, will be having our fourth UFO festival and conference. And that will be, I think, Richard Dolan, myself, I believe Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin, niece of Betty and Barney Hill, and
right,
Stanton's
right.
writing partner, the incomparable Denise Stoner, one of the most extraordinary abduction researchers we have, like Kathy, based in Florida. And if you're in the Northeast, come to that one. They're three terrific conferences. I'd recommend them all, although unless you are a clone or a totally split personality, last weekend of this month, it's a problem.
And you also have a website, which is peterrobbinsnewyork.com.
Well, ny.com, yeah.
I'm sorry, yes, okay. ny.com.
And it's woefully underdeveloped right now.
Well, it does have links to a lot of your articles,
yes,
and stuff.
Yes, and I will be more diligent as we move into the future. Anybody also that wants to see immediately where I'll speak next or contact me, you can do it through Facebook. I am the Peter Robbins that lives outside of Ithaca, New York.
There's also a link on the website to your Facebook page.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you, Peter.
A pleasure, Soraya. And as always, time has flown with you. And look forward to our next get-together here in the wonderful studio.
And I think you should consider turning that into a book, that whole bit about the ridicule factor.
Well, actually, it will be part of a book that will be coming out next year, which will be
really?
A collection of papers, articles, commentaries, etc.
Nice. All right. Okay, so next week is probably going to be the first of a two-part interview with David Politis on his new book, Missing 411 Hunters.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's going to happen after that. I guess we'll all find out together. I got some special stuff coming up still that I'm just trying to coordinate dates on. But that'll be next. And to take us out, this is Psyche Corporation with Strange Machine. Where did the road go.com?
Stars, they protest my future lies with